My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform, and I want to welcome you on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and our board of directors to a program that looks at ways to keep people out of hospital emergency rooms unless there's an emergency, using clinics and urgent care centers and other more appropriate places to deliver the care. And as we look to the future and see that scary slope of the healthcare cost curve, making sure that those who are seeking care at ERs, or I guess more properly, I'll hear from our colleagues, EDs, emergency departments, are actually in need of that level of care. Not only can we save some money, non-trivial amounts, as you'll hear, I'm sure, later today, but we'll make sure that those with the needs, with the true emergencies, will have less trouble getting cared for in the first place. We're going to try to sort out the different types of care settings that might be alternatives to EDs and how they differ from each other. We'll examine the extent to which these alternative settings can improve access to care for those with no primary care provider, and whether these clinics might ease access difficulties that we might encounter if millions more Americans seek care after they get coverage under the provisions of the health reform law, assuming we have a health reform law at that point. And we're pleased to have as a partner in today's program, WellPoint Incorporated, which I guess is best known as the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan in more than a dozen states, and covers more Americans than any other private insurer. It's a pleasure to share co-moderating duties and background setting duties with WellPoint's chief medical officer, among other of his duties, Dr. Samuel Nussbaum, who's going to get us started on the substantive conversation with an overview of today's topic. Sam, thanks for being with us.
Ed, thank you, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to what I believe is a open discussion, a dialogue on what alternatives for higher quality, more cost-effective care can be. You know, it's interesting, we're in a obviously historic building, and what many of us say that independent of where the Supreme Court, how the Supreme Court will rule over the next few weeks, is that there's already significant transformation taking place in healthcare. And people so often, when it comes to either patient-centered medical homes or new delivery models, or even here retail medicine and emergency room care, they use the expression, of course, the train has left the station. So this is one of those examples where there's real meaning in the train leaving the station. But what I'd like to do is, as Ed said, help set the stage for today's discussion. We know that emergency room visits are dramatically increasing in our nation. We have 150 million ER visits, and that's, to put in perspective, represents about 10% of all ambulatory care visits. Now, you'll hear a lot of numbers thrown out in terms of what percent of those emergency room visits could be avoided. And they could be avoided for two reasons. One is that through better care coordination, children with asthma getting optimal therapy and interventions maybe don't need to be in an emergency room, or people with heart failure on the right medications don't have deterioration health. So there's one group of visits that can be prevented because of better care coordination. But another group can be prevented in large part through alternative sites of care. People with acute medical conditions that do need to be seen, but need to be seen in a more appropriate setting. So the numbers that you'll hear, you know, range from maybe the high teens all the way up to 40% and more, but it is a very sizable number. There are also some myths in emergency room use. One myth is that the individuals that use emergency rooms do so because they don't have insurance and can't get into the care delivery system. And when you look at emergency room visits all in, only about 15% of them represent those individuals who have no insurance, and 20% Medicare, 15% Medicaid, and the vast bulk are those who have private insurance. Now, why do people visit emergency rooms? We'll hear much more about that today. But in a survey, a National Health Interview survey, about 80% said they didn't have immediately available, that's what's key, immediately available alternative options and providers. And about two-thirds believe that their medical condition was so serious that it warranted an ER visit. The other theme, as true in all of healthcare, is the concept of hotspotters. You know, Atul Gawande in his New Yorker article talked about hotspotters in terms of needing healthcare services. At WellPoint, for our 35 million members, 1% drive 28% of all healthcare costs, 5% drive 54%. Same is true for emergency rooms. About 5% of the frequent users account for 25% of all visits, and those are visits where there also are not only complex illness, but a lack of social support networks. Now, there are many reasons why, and I've commented on some, why visits are increasing, but certainly lack of access to coordinated care is one. The complication and complexity of illness, knowledge gaps in terms of when emergency room care is most appropriate. So the idea of having a deeper knowledge of how emergency room services should be used, and then also not knowing always about where those alternative services are. Now, if we look at it from the emergency room perspective, and again, we have colleagues up here who are on the front lines of care, emergency departments are full. And if we were to look at what happened with H1N1 flu a few years ago, we really overburdened emergency rooms so that in New York, for example, waits were in the many hours. And if you look at a report card of emergency rooms, it's not a report card that you would be proud to bring home if you were a student. So if you look at all of the elements of quality and environment and the liability environment, public health prevention and disaster preparedness, you know, overall emergency rooms have not fared well. Now, there is a horizon, there is a landscape ahead, and that is of alternative sites. And what one of our themes today will be retail settings for care. And there are many emerging retail settings in addition to those that are available, you know, obviously in primary care offices. And so we have pharmacies and Walgreens and CVS and their Minute and Take Care clinics. We have Walmart and Target, supermarkets. And if you look around the country, you see many, many of these retail centers as well as growing urgent care centers where there's a limited set of services. Often focused on rather routine care and minor illnesses, generally staffed by nurse professionals, nurse health professionals, and physician's assistants. As any of you who may have visited these sites know, that they're convenient hours, the waits are shorter, and I'll show you some data in a moment, but the costs are appreciably lower, both for the individual, for the employer, for insurers, and others. In fact, if we look at costs, we did a study in our HealthCore Research Outcomes subsidiary where we looked at 270,000 visits to emergency rooms, urgent care, and retail settings. And what you can see in the graph there is that if we look at cost, cost was far in excess of that of retail settings. Now, these are costs to WellPoint, not what the bill was, but what we paid, and averaged about $540 versus maybe one-tenth of that in the retail settings. So hugely expensive. And again, if you look at these diagnoses, they're the itises that are often self-limited, pharyngitis and sinusitis and otitis, and as well as colds, and very common uncomplicated urinary tract infections. So we know that care can be provided less costly. And when we looked at quality outcomes, we found the quality in the retail settings was higher, certainly comparable and likely higher than it was in emergency rooms, including the follow-up care. And again, we have lots of more and more linkages that you'll hear about later from Manish, my colleague, about how we're building this into primary care programs. So before I turn this back to Ed, the theme here is probably 5 to 6% of all healthcare expenditures in that range, for us at least, are occurring in settings where we know that care can be more highly coordinated and individuals can be better served. And it's our focus today that Ed and I will share with all of you, and certainly our speakers will, and your engagement, is how can we make this aspect of healthcare higher performing. Let me turn it back to Ed as you introduce our panelists.
Thank you very much, Sam. Let me do a little housekeeping first. You have a bunch of material in your packets, including more generously proportioned biographical information for our speakers than we'll be able to give them orally today, and a bunch of background material, all of which is available on our website at allhealth.org as well. We would, at the appropriate time, ask you to fill out the green question cards. There are also microphones on either side of the room that you can use to ask your question. And the infamous blue evaluation form, which we would ask you to fill out to help us improve these programs as we go along. We've got an impeccably knowledgeable group of panelists today with a broad range of experience. We're going to get brief presentations from each of them and then get to discussion and questions. Let me introduce them all so we don't disturb the flow of the conversation. We're going to start with Teen Hansen-Turton, who's the founding executive director of the Convenient Care Association, representing more than 1,250 retail health clinics with the capacity to serve more than 17 million people with basic health services. She also finds time to be the CEO of the National Nursing Centers Consortium, which is a nonprofit organization supporting the growth and development of about 250 nurse-managed health centers, serving more than 2.5 million vulnerable people. We'll then hear from Dr. Ativ Mehrotra, a policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. His research is focused on the measurement of healthcare quality and efficiency in applications of quality measures such as pay-per-performance and the impact of innovations in healthcare delivery. Dr. Mehrotra is board certified in both internal medicine and pediatrics. Then Manish Oza, who's a regional medical director for WellPoint based in Baltimore. He's a board certified emergency room physician, and he's the architect of WellPoint's emergency room utilization management initiative. I note he's also involved in another project we won't be talking about today, and that's WellPoint's venture with IBM to use Watson, you remember the Jeopardy champion computer, to help clinicians in real time with diagnosis and treatment plans. And we're talking with our colleagues at WellPoint about a future briefing on that topic. So we may be inviting Dr. Oza back for that discussion. And then finally, we're going to hear from Dr. Rick Kellerman, chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Kansas School of Medicine in Wichita. He oversees family medicine education for medical students, three family medicine residency programs, postgraduate medical education activities, and he's a past president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. He's been chair of their board, and in the interest of full disclosure, the chairman of our board, Bob Graham, was for many years the executive director of AAFB, and like Dr. Kellerman, is a graduate of the University of Kansas School of Medicine. So he has to be good. So let's start. Let's get off the ground with some real experience in the person of Teen Hansen-Turton. Teen?
Thank you very much, Ed, and thanks both to Ed and Sam, as well as the Alliance for Healthcare Reform and WellPoint for putting this session on this afternoon, and thank you for all of you for coming on this rainy day to Washington train station, and I can feel the trains rumbling underneath, so that feels fun. Anyways, I'm going to talk, sort of set the stage for the retail-based community care clinics and how we really talk about how we think, and we know we meet the need for accessibility, affordability, and quality of care in this country in terms of our model of care. Before I get started, I want to put things, the retail clinic model, in the context of what's going on in this country. You kind of know this because Sam already got us started with some of the statistics, but let's just look at what the situation looks like in this country at this point in time. We have limited access to routine and preventive care. It's something we all report, whether we have insurance coverage or not. Millions of consumers and patients don't have an established relationship with a primary care physician or other primary care provider or health insurance. Healthcare costs do keep rising to unsustainable rates. Our employers are facing it. And consumers, especially post-2008, are consistently pressed for time when it comes to accessing and fitting healthcare into their overall busy lives. And we have industries, for example, like the transportation industries, that actually can't fit routine healthcare into their lives at all, where alternative types of modes of healthcare is a good vehicle for them to get care. And all of this access could worsen potentially if we don't have a plan for treating 32-plus million Americans that may get on health insurance post the Supreme Court's decision coming up. And all of that, of course, you'll see the graph is enlightened with the fact that we have had for probably the last 3 or 4 decades a physician shortage in this country. So one of the things that we've been coined a disruptive innovation, I think others are going to talk about that by Harvard professor Clayton Christensen, but simply the value proposition of the retail-based convenient care clinic model is about being accessible because of our location and where we are, affordable, the lowest cost option that's non-subsidized by the federal or other government, and we provide very high quality, and you'll hear about that. You heard also from Sam some of his data, and you'll hear something from Atif later on. So what are convenient care clinics? For those of you who may not know about them, usually we go in the audience now, folks have visited one or are familiar with them. But let me just describe them simply. They're small healthcare facilities, usually with 1 or 2 exam rooms that are located in high traffic retail outlet pharmacies. With pharmacies, we have retail pharmacies as one type of location. We have, as you heard, supermarkets, and that's a growing location, especially with hospitals opening partnerships with local supermarkets. You see them in big box retailers, for example, as Target. The ownership of these clinics vary very much. You have for-profits running them. You actually have some federal qualified health centers or community health centers running them now as well. And you have health systems increasingly that are opening and managing these healthcare facilities. The clinics are usually staffed by nurse practitioners or physician assistants, but not exclusively. We also have clinics that actually have physicians in them. But all of them do it with local physician collaboration. And they have a very focused scope of services. I'm not going to go over that because it's in your packet, but you can get a sense of the more limited services. These clinics are not there to be ongoing primary care services. It's not a medical home per se, but they are there to provide services on the more routine primary care level and some chronic disease maintenance and management. So a little bit about the Community Care Association. We were started in 2006, so we're actually a relatively young organization. Today, in those days, we represented about 150 clinics. We focus very much on quality. Today, that number is close to 1,400. Our clinics represent most of the clinics operators that are out in the country, and our membership is pretty diverse because it includes for-profits, nonprofits, as well as hospital members and others that are part of the industry. When we started, as I mentioned, we were small. The concept was pretty novel, and Rick and I were talking beforehand. We've been on these sessions previously. It was a very novel concept. Clinics were mostly, in the early days, cash only. They offered a very limited scope of services. That has since changed. And part of the change was that the consumer, the patient, or the employee went to the employer and said, we want to go to places like this rather than the expensive emergency room. And also they put pressure on their insurance companies and said, this is a good vehicle for us to get more basic healthcare services rather than go into an emergency room or other care that would be more expensive. So a lot of us partnering with our insurance colleagues around the country was really a drive from the consumer early on. Early on also, I think many questioned the viability of the model. I think that has since changed, and certainly with the growth in the industry, I think we've shown that we're here to stay, and we only plan to grow and be a stronger partner with the overall healthcare system. And there was certainly some opposition early on from more organized medicine. I think we have allayed the fears in terms of how we really partner and see the medical home and our physician colleagues and our hospital colleagues as key partners. We are part of the overall healthcare team and can actually alleviate the burden on some of the pressure points in the overall healthcare system. So where are we today? As I mentioned, when we put this PowerPoint presentation together, we had about 1,350 clinics and growing. We're probably closer to 1,400 today. There's generally been a greater acceptance publicly and support for this type of model and because it's patient-centered, it's consumer-friendly. We have a lot of more partnerships today with traditional healthcare providers and practices that are part of the overall stakeholder group when it comes to healthcare. And many health systems also now operate these clinics, and we really see this as very favorable to us because it's mainstream healthcare that said we want these types of clinics part of our overall healthcare system. How the healthcare systems do it, they do it a little bit differently. They tend to put these clinics in supermarkets that are a little bit outside their catchment area. But part of that is really a way for them to actually serve a population that may live further away from sort of the flagship healthcare system. But it's also a way to gain new access to new patients as the healthcare systems grow. The scope of services also is growing with an eye towards disease prevention and chronic disease monitoring, but all of that usually happens in a strong partnership with a medical home. In general, I was asked us to talk about sort of traditional, non-traditional care growing. There is actually a movement around the country, and part of that goes back to what I started out with, the fact that we do have a primary care physician shortage. There are other models out there. You have the nurse-managed health clinic model that tends to be a model that serves more of an underserved population, Medicaid and uninsured, that's run by nurse practitioners that provide primary care, health promotion, and disease prevention services. We've got the urgent care model. That's about a little shy of 9,000 of those clinics around the country that, like the community care clinic model, also provides walk-in access but have a broader scope of services. Many hospitals run urgent care as well. And then we have another, you know, type of provider out there, the telehealth programs that are actually opening. Some of them do kiosk-based kind of care. Some of them are more home-based. But those are the types of non-traditional health care services we're now seeing in the country. And part of that, obviously, is to provide access to much-needed care. So what are some of the health care reform opportunities? We were asked to talk a little bit about that. Well, one thing we learned from Massachusetts in 2007 is that just because you provide somebody with an insurance card doesn't mean they have access to care. If you all recall, about 400,000 people in Massachusetts, adults, got access to an insurance card. And what happened, the emergency rooms, again, were flooded, and the physicians had to close their panels because they were overburdened. So part of health care reform is really having a plan for how do we provide access to people when they get health care, and the right access at the right place. And we think that the community care clinic, we fit a very sweet spot in collaboration with our partners that are sitting on this panel, because we can be a very early resource for health care services and also a feeder into the overall health care system. We also see our members more and more being included in the medical home and accountable care organizations. Certainly in terms of accountable care organizations, we are the lowest cost option in primary care, so it makes sense to have us part of an ACO. And we really, again, are in a sweet spot. We also, all of our members use electronic health records, and we did that from the get-go. It was actually a requirement to be part of the convenient care industry, and our association was that everybody used electronic health records, and we thought that was critical for the model, because our onset was always, we don't want to be the ongoing primary care resource. We're going to need to be able to communicate with our physician colleagues, with our hospital colleagues, and so forth. Nationally, there is a focus on preventive care and wellness, and obviously it's a sweet spot for us. We do a lot of immunizations and education in general. And I think we're engaging a lot of creative partnerships with lots of providers, like community health centers and hospitals and so forth. What does research show? It shows we're good for access. You know, we're open 7 days a week. We follow retail clinic hours. That's the value proposition, and there's no appointments necessary. We're good for the cost. Like I mentioned, we're the lowest cost option. You heard that from Sam as well in his introduction to this panel. And you're going to hear a lot about the quality care that we provide. All of it is because we actually practice evidence-based protocols, and we have that built into our electronic health records. Finally, in terms of growth, we are in an expansion phase again, and that's something we're excited about. You're going to see more clinics. You're going to see more clinic partnerships with actual hospital systems and others. You're going to see some of the scope of services expanding with an eye towards disease prevention and some chronic disease monitoring. You're going to see more health systems and hospitals and more traditional providers getting into this type of care. And with that, I'm going to end and look forward to the dialogue following this.
Great. Thank you, team. If we could get your slide advancer. We'll now turn to Dr. Mehrotra.
Well, thanks. So what I was hoping to do was, in the couple minutes I have, to give you an overview of what do we know from the research perspective on one of the alternatives to emergency departments that is a focus of today, is retail clinics. So one of the amazing things is that retail clinics have entered the health care landscape. They've generated a lot of controversy. And the policy issues that are being addressed are very similar to the policy issues we're addressing throughout the healthcare system on quality, access, and cost. And there's been debate about the quality of the care that's been provided at these clinics. Some have argued, hey, these clinics are great. They're going to provide high-quality care because they use well-trained nurse practitioners, strict evidence use of evidence-based guidelines. And others have argued and been concerned that these clinics are going to deliver poor quality care. And in particular, because the clinics are often owned and operated by pharmacy chains, maybe these will lead to overprescribing of antibiotics. And I think that's been a critical concern of physicians as well as patients. There's also been a debate about access issues. As people on the committee have argued that we're having a problem with getting patients into primary care, and these are a great alternative to primary care, a great alternative so that people can increase access. And maybe they can even go into underserved communities and become a new safety net provider. While others have argued, and this has been mostly focused on the fact that when patients go to one of these clinics, they're going to undermine primary care physician relationships, and what negative impact will that have? And then the last policy issue that's been discussed or policy debate on this has been on the issue of costs. Do retail clinics, maybe they'll decrease emergency department visits? That's how we started this conversation today. And maybe they can decrease overall healthcare spending. Well, others have been concerned that, oh, these clinics are just going to drive healthcare spending up because patients are going to go to the retail clinic and then they're going to go to their doctor's office and then you're just going to have more care, and that's actually going to drive healthcare spending up. So what I wanted to do is quickly go over with you some of the research that has been trying to, we have done as well as others have done to try to address these policy issues. On the issue of quality, what we did is a study that where we looked at the care that was provided in four healthcare settings: retail clinics, physician offices, urgent care centers, and emergency departments. And we looked at a lot of different aspects of care for simple acute problems, the kind of things that people go to retail clinics for. Contrary to the concerns that we had seen, had been expressed, we didn't find any evidence that these clinics were rampantly overprescribing antibiotics. We found very similar antibiotic prescribing rates for these conditions at retail clinics compared to other care sites. We also looked at an overall assessment of quality, where we looked to see whether the care provided at retail clinics was consistent with evidence-based guidelines. And when we say evidence-based guidelines, we're talking about guidelines that are published by physician groups such as the Infectious Disease Society of America. And again, a very consistent story that the quality of care that we were seeing at retail clinics was very similar to what we saw at the other care sites. And this is also very consistent with other work that people have done, where many of the quality concerns do not appear to be borne out in the data. Patient satisfaction is quite high at these clinics. And then in terms of quality, looking at things such as follow-up visit rates, concordance with guidelines, comparing to other care sites, consistently the story is that retail clinics appear to be providing care that's of equal quality to physician offices or other care settings. On the issue of access, what we've done is some work where we've tried to look at where these clinics are located and what communities do they serve. Most of the clinics, 90% plus, were located in urban areas where most people in the United States live. And one of the things I thought was really notable about this work is that Tina mentioned that these clinics appear to be kind of, you know, early, kind of novel entries into the healthcare landscape. But what we found was really interesting was that a large fraction of the U.S. population already has access to one of these clinics. So really, they do have that potential to impact a large number of people in the United States in terms of how they receive care. We found 38% of the urban population lives within a 10-minute drive. Contrary to the idea that, oh, these clinics are going to be this new safety net provider, we don't find any evidence that these clinics are preferentially located in underserved communities. They seem to be located in the same communities as doctor's offices. So we looked at what fraction of these clinics are located in federally designated health professional shortage areas. One of the common questions is, who goes to this kind of new novel source of receiving care? We've looked at this from a variety of perspectives. One study we did is we looked at people who go to retail clinics, doctor's offices, and emergency departments, and looked at the age distribution, for example, one thing, about who goes to these clinics. And we found that the largest fraction of patients who go to these clinics are in this young adult group, 18 to 44, very similar to what you see at an emergency department. But I think the most notable thing is very different than patients who go to a doctor's office, a primary care office, where we saw, not surprisingly, people who go to a primary care office tend to be a little bit more on the older side, as well as young infants. So the story here is that retail clinics appear to be attracting a different patient population than those who go to doctor's offices. Another critical concern is, are these clinics going to undermine primary care physician relationships? And one of the things that I thought was really notable from our results was just over a third of the patients who went to a retail clinic reported having a primary care physician. That's a problem in itself, but I think the key point being there is that the vast majority of patients did not have a relationship with a primary care physician and therefore no relationship to disrupt. And so another key finding from our results of who's going to these clinics. Lastly is on the issue of costs. We again looked at what was the difference in costs going to a retail clinic versus some of these other care sites. And we don't want to just focus on that visit itself. We want to focus on the visit, the prescriptions, the follow-up test, the laboratory test, what we have termed an episode of care. And what we found, consistent with what Sam introduced, was that retail clinics were about 30 to 40% cheaper than a doctor's office or urgent care center, and about average 80% cheaper than the care for a similar condition for a similar patient at an emergency department. So at least potentially substantial cost savings. The question we then wanted to ask was, you know, there's been a lot of debate about what fraction of patients who go to an emergency department don't need to be there. We wanted to slightly frame that differently and say, what fraction of the visits in a an emergency department could potentially be addressed at an alternative care site? And so we looked at a national sample of emergency department visits and looked at the diagnosis codes that were provided there. And what our estimate was that about 27% of the visits at an emergency department could potentially be addressed at one of these other care sites. And those are for things such as sore throats, conjunctivitis or pink eye, sinus infections, et cetera. I think the other key point to make is the vast majority of emergency department visits were for problems that cannot be addressed at one of these other care sites, more than almost three-quarters of them. If you say, well, a lot of those visits are in the middle of the night, we limited it to the number of emergency department visits that were when these alternative care sites were open, and that brought it down to about 17% of emergency department visits. But overall, our estimate was that about $4.4 billion could be saved if we could somehow find, and I think Manish will talk about this coming up, about how can you make, if people can move from the emergency department to these alternative care sites, how much money could we potentially save? Now, I think that $4.4 billion, even here in Washington, D.C., is a lot of money. But we should also be conscious of the that estimate is consistent with what others have found as potentially savings if retail clinics become more prominent nationally. But we should also be very conscious that this is only a small piece of the overall healthcare budget. Even if we were able to save these $4.4 billion, it's less than 1% of overall healthcare spending. So an important way to decrease healthcare spending, but certainly not a panacea for our healthcare cost issue. So just to summarize the work that we and others have done, in terms of the quality issues, we really find no evidence to support the concerns that have been raised that retail clinics are going to decrease healthcare quality. On the access side, we would argue that the data shows that the people who are going to retail clinics appear to be a different patient population than who go to doctor's offices, and the vast majority of them do not have a primary care physician. And on the cost side, at least there is the potential, and I should emphasize potential, for substantial cost savings if patients were to shift their care. I'll end by just noting some things that we should be aware of and hopefully prompt further conversation, is that I think most of you in the audience are aware of the potential benefits of retail clinics, both the convenience, the cost savings. But we also should be aware of some of the issues that we, as this moves forward. First is that as people start seeing more and more providers in the healthcare system, is this going to increase the fragmentation of care? One of the common complaints I hear from my patients is, don't you guys ever talk to each other? And so how do we address those fragmentation issues? Emergency departments in the United States are already financially strained, and what impact will this have if patients start going there? And then we also have to be conscious of the fact that our patients going to be able to effectively decide where their condition should be addressed. In other words, can they self-triage to the right care site? And so these are just some of the issues that we should be thinking about as we move forward. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Atif. Now we'll turn to somebody who's been thinking a lot about how to seize those potential benefits and address those concerns, Dr. Manish Oza.
Thank you, Ed. So I joined WellPoint a little over 5 years ago, was a full-time ER physician, still practice clinically here in Maryland, and I got the challenge of how do you handle avoidable ER visits. So the first thing I and our team did is we started to talk to some of our clients, and the consensus from the employees and the people we talked to was it was very unclear in the market, where do I go for what? When do I go to the emergency room? When do I go to a retail health clinic? When can I access an urgent care? So it was clear when we were designing this program that that was one of our missions, to make the information as transparent to everyone possible. The second challenge was, how do you unravel the fact that a consumer knows, almost everybody in this room, that you can go to an emergency room 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without an appointment, and get treated, whether you have one of the itises that Atif and Sam talked about, the otitis, the earaches, the strep throat, the urinary tract infections. You know, and I know, you can go anytime you want, and you can get treated. So we started to think about program design. And we said, I forgot to change my slide, sorry. We need to have a viral program that gets the information out there to all of our members, that's easily accessible, not behind a firewall, so that anybody and everybody can access it. The second challenge was, how can we leverage technology and put the information where and when the member needs it at that point in time when they're having one of these potential itises? So if they're having a sore throat and it's Friday and it's 7 o'clock and they can't access their primary care doctor, if they have a primary care doctor, where do they go? So clearly there was an opportunity for us there. And then the last part of this was, we needed to be a little bit unconventional based on past programs. So we needed to be proactive and not what we commonly do is be reactive. So a mistake happens or a lost opportunity, and then we slap potentially you on the wrist or tell you after the fact, hey, you shouldn't have done that or you could have saved money. Well, our actuary tells us for our commercial population in California, 87% of the time an avoidable ER visit happens only once in a calendar year. So are there frequent flyers to the emergency room? Yes. Do they potentially cost the system a tremendous amount of money? Yes, but why the frequent flyer goes to the ER is much different than why the person goes to the ER for an avoidable ER visit. And hence, this is an opportunity to educate this population. So we came up with this program, which is not as complicated as it looks. We'll start on the top right corner. We have the 24/7 nurse hotline. We staff this 24 hours a day, as the term says, and these nurses are registered nurses that can triage our members. Some of the challenges there were the nurses used to ask a lot of questions that may not be relevant. If you've got strep throat, the last thing you want to do is be on the phone speaking when you can't speak very well and it hurts a lot. So we streamlined the whole process so that the nurses asked only the relevant questions that were necessary to triage you to whether it be a retail health clinic, your primary care doctor, or the emergency room when appropriate. The second thing we did with our pilot group is we created a brochure. We create a lot of brochures. You get a lot of brochures in the mail. This brochure, I think it cut to the chase very quickly. It showed our members and what the potential savings opportunity was. It explained what retail health clinics were, as Atif explained them, and then also explained what urgent cares are and what they can treat. On the second page of this brochure, we listed the top 17 diagnoses or complaints that people could go to the emergency room for, or were going to the emergency room for, that could access a retail health clinic or an urgent care. So we mailed that to the pilot group. And then we said, well, do we stop there? Because we all know a lot of these brochures end up in the garbage or filed away. And we kept thinking about, it's Friday, it's 7 o'clock, and this member's child or they themselves have a sore throat. Are they going to find that brochure? Chances are not. So we said, well, let's go one step further. Let's email our members reminders about ER alternatives during high peak utilization of the emergency room. So this is during allergy season, where a lot of people develop sinusitis. During the flu season, we know a lot of people don't feel well and rush to the emergency room. And then lastly, the summertime, where we are now to presently, the weekend warriors, all the jogging's happening, the cleaning of the roses or the cutting of the rose bushes, a lot of lacerations, contusions, sprains, these things happen during this time. So we send out email reminders to members saying, hey, here's the information you need. If you potentially have one of these conditions, you can access one of these ER alternatives. We also created an online tutorial where if somebody wanted to learn more about retail health clinics or urgent cares, they could go to this storyboard, and it's an online tutorial that educates our members about ER wait times, costs, and when is it appropriate to use the emergency room versus ER alternatives. The last two components, the Google Map, makes a whole lot of sense, right? Type in your zip code, find an ER alternative, have all the resources that the member needs to make an informed decision within a couple clicks. So make it really, really easy. The last component, smartphones. I think we're all jazzed up about smartphones, and I keep getting asked, when are you going to create a smartphone application? And I usually answer that question by asking a question. Creating a smartphone application with the Google Map is very, very easy to do. We've actually created a beta version, and we will one day have that. The challenge is getting a member to download that app and have it impact their decision. So when it's 7 o'clock on a Friday, are they going to remember or even find that ER alternative app? That's debatable. So then we said, well, let's slice the data. Let's look at who the highest utilizers of the ER, and it's exactly what Atheeb shared with you. They're the 20 to 42-year-olds with kids that may not have an established relationship with a primary care doctor because they're relatively young and they're healthy. So we know a lot of these people don't have a primary care doctor, and that same population also develops the itises like everybody else. So where do we think this population is looking when they're ill and it's Friday and it's 7 o'clock? And so we said they're probably going to Google like I did, whether I'm looking for a pizza place, a restaurant, or if I'm preparing for this lecture. I go to Google, Yahoo, or Bing, and I type things in and I try to become informed. So we said, wow, we've got all this great information on this brochure that probably got thrown away. We've got that email we sent that may have gotten deleted. We've got all this great information that the member needs on this storyboard in Google Map. So why not get it out there in cyberspace when someone Googles urgent care, retail health clinic, or Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, our ad will be there, they can click on it, and everything the member needs is right there in front of them to make an informed decision. Also, the information about the nurse hotline is there, so if they want to talk to someone to reaffirm their decision to go to a retail health clinic, the nurse can say, that's the right decision, or they can say, no, if you're having chest pain, a retail health clinic is not the right place you should be going. You should be going to the emergency room. So we opened it up in our 14 states to all of our members and to anybody that lives in that state. So if you live in Virginia and you Google Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, whether you're one of our members or not, you can access this information, whether you're Medicare, Medicaid, with one of our competitors, or have no insurance. And that was a decision that our leadership made, which was they felt was important to educate not just our population, but everybody in one of our states. On the back end here, you can see if a member goes to the emergency room for an avoidable ER visit, we send them a message on their EOB that says you had an avoidable ER visit, and if you want to learn more, you can Google this information or you can Yahoo or Bing it. We also send out these automated phone calls that gives the member the option of giving us their email so we can push them to this landing page that has all this information. And then the last thing we do is our My Health Advantage note. This is something that our members get, and it's a gaps in care alert that's proprietary. It's something that we created at WellPoint. And so if you haven't gotten some of your preventive exams, like a mammogram or a colonoscopy, we send our members a reminder, and we also send them a message if they have an avoidable ER visit and say, you potentially could have saved time and money. If you want to learn more about avoidable ER visits, access this webpage. I'm going to talk really briefly about LifeHealth Online. This is a new modality that we're going to be working on in the near future, and this is where you can go on the web and access a primary care doctor to be treated for one of the itises. Where I think this has the biggest potential is if we plug this into a patient-centered medical home. So imagine a day in the near future where you go to see your primary care doctor and you can do it via the web, someone that knows you, that has access to your medical health record, and can treat you, triage you to a retail health clinic, an urgent care, or an emergency room when appropriate. The last part, the last slide is our patient-centered medical home model. We're big proponents of the patient-centered medical home. The retail health clinics and the urgent cares are out there because there's going to need to be increased access. But we are big supporters of the patient-centered medical home. We would prefer that members access their primary care doctor, but we realize that there is an opportunity and there's limited access. So retail health clinics and urgent cares will play a role as healthcare reform comes upon us in the near future. I'll stop there.
Great. Thanks very much. Manish, turn it now to Rick Cullen.
Okay. Thank you for asking us to speak. I'm here with the American Academy of Family Physicians, and first I want to say that we agree with the concern about the overuse and inappropriate use of the emergency departments throughout the country. And we come to this due to a variety of different reasons. First of all, we have a lot of members of the AAFP who either have part-time or full-time jobs as emergency physicians. Secondly, if you go to a rural area of our country and have some kind of an accident or chest pain and you go to the emergency room, more than likely it's a family physician that's going to see you. And third, oftentimes it's our patients that end up in the emergency room. I think it might be important to kind of back up just a little bit and ask, why are emergency rooms overburdened, overcrowded, and sometimes people access the emergency room inappropriately? And there are a number of reasons for that, but I don't think that we can come to any other conclusion. At least one of those reasons is the neglect of the primary care system in the United States. Neglect through a lack of policy making that supports primary care, payment systems that support primary care, and a medical education system that works against primary care. When we think of people that show up unnecessarily in the emergency department, we can divide this out in a number of ways. We've been talking about acute symptoms, sore throat, earache, that sort of thing, where a patient comes in because they need convenient care, they want it right now, they're having pain, and either they don't have a family physician or their family physician is full and might even tell them to go to the emergency room. And there's a second type of visit that oftentimes we can help decrease with good primary care. Those are called ambulatory sensitive conditions. In other words, if I do my job treating heart failure or asthma and do a good job with preventive medicine, oftentimes we can keep people out of the emergency room. And so I think there are a couple of things that both primary care and the emergency physician and the emergency departments can work together so that we have the emergency departments that if you and I have an accident and it's serious and there's trauma or severe chest pain, that the emergency doctors are free to take care of us. A few years ago, I was asked to chair a working group on retail clinics for the American Academy of Family Physicians. And the first retail clinic was actually started by a family physician in Minneapolis. What we did is we had several meetings with Teen. We met with the leadership of the various retail clinics that were existent at that time. We talked to patients, and we also talked to family physicians throughout the country, had several focus groups. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what we heard from the family physicians about retail clinics. And remember that we have over 100,000 members of the AAFP, so we have opinions that are all over the place, but they kind of break down into some of the things that Ativ talked about. Here were some of the concerns that our members had. They were concerned about the fragmentation of care with a retail clinic. In fact, more than once we heard this is just one more thing getting between the doctor and the patient. There was concern about the relationship between the doctor-patient relationship, ongoing continuity of care, and coordination of care. They were concerned about skimming of some of the, I would say, simple sort of things that they take care of the offices, in their offices, that sometimes actually contributed to the bottom line and made their days go a little bit faster. When you're seeing patients with dizziness and headaches and backaches all day, it's sometimes kind of nice to see an earache and a sore throat. And oftentimes these are small businesses. They work on a very small margin, and they were concerned about that. Now, to this point, I don't know of a single family physician office that has gone out of business because of a retail clinic. So just to set that straight. Another thing they were concerned about, and I thought this was interesting, and they called it the medicalization of symptoms, that just because you have a runny nose or a sore throat doesn't mean you need to go to the emergency room, doesn't mean you need to go to a retail clinic, doesn't necessarily mean you need to go to your family physician. But sometimes we've actually encouraged people to get care that, at least when I was a kid, it wasn't very serious and you don't really need to go to the doctor. Having a physician that can educate you about that can certainly help prevent some of those unnecessary visits. At the same time, we heard from family physicians who were supportive of the concept of retail clinics. Some were very pragmatic. They realized that there are problems with access and that we need better entry points into the primary care system. Some members became the local physician supervisors for retail clinics. Some that were trying to build their practices looked at the retail clinics as a referral source into their practice. So I think Ativ really nicely summed this up in his research, and I'd say that our focus groups and our background really helped support what Ativ was saying. As a result of the retail clinics, we challenged our members that they need to look differently at how they provide care. And we saw a number of innovations from members in terms of how to take care of patients who have acute illness and need to come in at that time. I think of somebody in Wichita who works on the line at Spirit AeroSystems and gets a call from the school that their kid has an earache. They don't want to come into my office and sit in my waiting room for 3 hours for something that really takes me a couple of minutes to take care of. And so we told our members, if you don't like retail clinics or if you're challenged by them, you've got to change the way that you practice. We saw physicians extend their office hours. It's not just 9 to 5, but extending office hours into the evening, early morning office hours, not taking a break at noon, but handling some scheduling. Some innovations like a quick clinic. There's a family physician in Texas who devotes her noon hour so that individuals who call in that day, she can get them right in, take care of them. Open access scheduling, which means that you leave some appointment slots in your schedule each day for people to call in that day. And open access scheduling, particularly on Mondays, when people have tried to put off care over the weekend so that they don't get hit with the cost of an emergency room visit, but rather can wait, see the physician on Monday, come into the office. And so particularly on Mondays and during peak times, having open access scheduling. Emailing patients. There are a lot of questions that come up that, frankly, we can take care over an email system. You don't necessarily need a face-to-face visit. And we heard about the what we call the frequent flyers, individuals who sometimes use the emergency room very inappropriately and come in very frequently. There have been some studies that if you put these if you identify them and put them together and sit them down in a group visit periodically, you can cut the number of inappropriate emergency room visits that they make. So there are a number of innovations that different physician practices have put into place. Now, since Tina and I started working on this about a decade or so ago, there have also been an evolution in the healthcare system. For example, greater integration of the healthcare system. We see more physicians who are employed by hospitals and healthcare systems. That's going to play into the into their feelings about retail clinics. The ACOs, are part of that integration effort. And then, as you've also heard, the patient-centered medical home as an innovation, which looks at team-based care, primary care, trying to provide comprehensive care, good access, continuity of care, and coordination of care, all as part of a team. I think that there are some questions that remain about the retail clinics, and some of these are going to be answered over time and with evolution of the healthcare system. Here's some of the questions. Do retail clinics fit into the system of care, or do they promote fragmentation of care and promote episodic care? Do they integrate into the system of care, or are they standalone? What is the location of the retail clinic? If it's to offload the emergency department, is it close to an emergency department so that patients can access it? What is the scope of practice? Historically, when these started, the retail clinics were there for very acute sort of problems. And as you saw from Ative's research, urinary tract infections, sore throats, and earaches, there's been a move into chronic care. And in terms of screening, there's a big difference between screening for a condition like diabetes or checking a blood sugar periodically for somebody that has diabetes. That's a whole different ballpark than ongoing management of diabetes because of the medications, potential problems with medications. Patients oftentimes have comorbid or other conditions. Do retail clinics contribute or detract from continuity and coordination of care? Do they detract from the financial health of primary care offices? And as I mentioned, this is important because most of the offices are small practices. And will they really offload the work of the emergency department? Ative's research showed that 17% to 27%, depending on how you count, of office visits in emergency rooms are for non-urgent care. Most emergency rooms have adapted to this. They have triage centers that if you have a sore throat or earache, you go over to one side of the office. And those generally don't take a whole lot of time to treat. So they may decrease a percentage of the non-urgent visits. Whether they really save in terms of time and even cost is another issue. With that, I'll go ahead and turn it back over to Ed, and I guess we'll open it up for questions then.
You bet, and I would also invite our panelists, if they've heard anything they want to take serious issue with or reinforce, that they can feel free to chime in at this point. And I would add Dr. Nussbaum to that list as somebody who's dealt with this stuff. You can see some of your friends and colleagues in the audience holding up green cards. That's a good thing. It's where you write your question, and someone from our staff will bring it forward so that we can make sure it gets asked. The real way to make sure it gets asked is to go to one of the microphones and ask as concise a question as you can after identifying yourself and your institutional affiliation, if you would. And we have a couple. Let me just, while you're sorting those out, let me just ask the panelists in general, I guess. We had asked you to sort of look at policy implications, and each of you has really done that in one degree or another. One that has arisen already is some states, notably the state of Washington, deciding to legally change the likely reimbursement, as I understand it, for an emergency room visit based on the classification of the reason for the visit after the fact, in perfect 2020 hindsight, I guess it is. Now, that law has been suspended in its operation by the governor, and I wonder if you would have any opinions about the efficacy of such laws, or if there are other ways to address this question in a policy arena.
Maybe I'll jump in with just a couple of quick points with that. If I understand the state of Washington law that was proposed, which is that if a patient who has Medicaid insurance goes to the emergency department for one of a condition that, based on the diagnosis codes, is felt to be something that could have been treated elsewhere, that visit won't be reimbursed. and obviously the patient would have to pay for it. And so I actually have a lot of concerns about that approach. It's a little bit like Monday morning quarterbacking, you know, to try to figure out what was urgent and what was not urgent in, I think, a relatively blunt way is going to have some issues. And I think we know from prior work that some of those, what you'll do is you will, of course, be effective in decreasing some of those patients going to the emergency department for that, and I think that's a positive benefit. But I think the concern comes down to one of the points I made before, is that to ask the American citizen, average American citizen, say, what's urgent versus not urgent, it's hard to know. You're not trained as a doc, and so how do you know what's urgent or not urgent? And I think the concern is that some fraction of patients who have an urgent problem will say, oh, I don't want to deal with those cost issues, and therefore not seek care, and that's going to have both public health negative impact as well as potentially negative cost impact, too. So I think while I think this is an urgent, important problem, I'm not sure that is the policy lever that should be applied.
Anyone else? Manish, you're still practicing emergency medicine. How does that fit into your experience?
I agree with Steve. It's difficult to expect the common person to be able to diagnose themselves. If they could, then they wouldn't need physicians. You know, potentially there's some opportunity, there's some very low-hanging fruit, such as prescription refills. Sometimes we still have people coming to the ER for tetanus shots, physicals, sports camps, signings of forms, believe it or not, that still does exist. So perhaps there's a very, very small number of things you could, retrospectively penalize somebody for going to the emergency room for. But I still think the track that we're on and trying to empower and educate people, I think the common person, or at least most of the people in this room, don't want to wait in an ER for 3 hours, don't want to be surrounded if you've cut your finger while you're cutting your bagel Monday morning, want to be surrounded by a bunch of sick people with the flu or any other ailment. So again, this is a real opportunity for us to educate people, and I think most people, especially the way benefit designs are going, whether it's consumer-driven health plans or the increasing copays that are coming for the ER, don't want to wait in the emergency room. So the challenge is, will we have enough retail health clinics? Will we have enough patient-centered medical homes with open access and after hours? Because let's face it, a lot of these things are happening after 5. You come home, you pick your kids up from daycare, and they've got a fever. So where do you go? And what do you do if you can't get your primary care doctor? So a lot of opportunity. I think what Washington started is not the solution.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, go right ahead.
Yes. From Ms. Hanson-Churton, you mentioned that I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. You mentioned that your clinics have electronic health records. How does that work in a city like Washington, where everybody has a different one? A hospital center has one, and GW has one, and Georgetown has one, and Sibley has another. First of all, do they all use the same one, all of your clinics? And second, what do you do with the fact that, no two large places use the same one, unless they're in the same system?
Thanks for the question. That's a great question. I think that's an issue we all face in the healthcare system now, what they call interoperability issue of most of the electronic health records. Right now, I mean, what we do is, first of all, to share your record, you have to have patient consent. I'll give you an example of how I get care, and I happen to go, my closest retail clinic provider happens to be MinuteClinic. I take my 11-year-old son there. We happen to live about an hour and a half from outside city of Philadelphia. We go to Chubb Faculty Practice, that's where his pediatrician is. When he goes to a MinuteClinic, what will happen is he'll get, whatever the diagnosis, if he needs a prescription, he'll get a prescription. That record actually is integrated with, it happens to be with the Chubb, medical practice. So there, it's an online record. If not, that will be faxed the old-fashioned way. I think we share with all, everybody probably in the room in the healthcare field is that we would like to see more of this done electronically. Now, we know we have some of our colleagues, some of our members have relationships with hospitals and health systems where they are integrating the record. I'll give another example that happens to involve MinuteClinic, which is they have a partnership with, for example, Cleveland Clinic, where they are integrating their medical record with the Cleveland Clinic's medical record. So it's possible, but you have, you know, obviously they are contractual in a partnership there. But, you know, share the challenges with you. With that said, I would say the force is with all of us if we can get over this hurdle, because it is truly how we can, you know, probably provide more integrated care. And that's where the benefit of an accountable care organization, an integrated medical home, the same thing, where you can have records and you can see people going through the different systems when there's partnerships.
Do you ever think of printing it out and giving it to the patient to take to his primary care physician?
I'm sorry, one more time?
Do you ever think of printing it out and giving it to the patient to get it to the primary care physician?
Great, great follow-up question. You actually get, when you leave as a patient, if you've been to one, you actually get your record with you as well. So it's a combination. One, I mean, again, it's the patient has to consent to get that record. So not unlike probably going, you know, to your primary care practice, but yes, you get your record with you. In some cases also, patients have electronic, their own health records, their personal health records. It can be sent to you via email. And you always get a follow-up call that evening or the day after from the provider in the clinic to make sure that whatever the recommendations were, you followed up on that.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment on that. I think that's a really good question. It brings up the issue of whether the retail clinic is coordinated or integrated with the larger system, or whether it's a standalone out there. I can tell you, though, that one of the things we heard from the docs, and whether it's the emergency room retail clinics or urgent care clinics, they come in on Monday morning, and sometimes they get faxes of a record or electronic records, so they're walking in on a busy day, and here's a bunch of patient information, and now they feel responsible for it. That brings up all sorts of liability issues. Do they call the patient? Who's responsible to follow up? They have, let's say it's a paper record. They have a piece of paper that now they have to file and put in the record. So there's a lot of downstream practical things that come out of this. I think your question really touches on a lot of different issues.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm Bob Rode, BMJ. For Dr. Mitrotta, I noticed from one of your slides there that the data was published in 2009. This is a very dynamic, changing area. Is there anything that would suggest that this data does not apply now because it's so dynamic and changing, or do you think everything is pretty much holds true today?
So we share with you a bunch of different studies that have been published over the last couple of years. We do have a couple of follow-up studies that are hopefully be published soon, and most of those data are very consistent with what we found. So at least to date, and this is sort of an ongoing process, you're always looking to see if things change. None of the things that I shared with you, I think, at least from the data, the more recent data I have been refuted. I don't hear a different story right now.
Okay. Hi, Winifred Quinn with AARP. Dr. Kellerman mentioned that he, as far as he knows, that no physician offices have closed as a result of retail clinics. However, in states like Missouri, dozens of retail clinics were closed because of organized medicine's opposition to the retail clinic model. And so I wanted to hear from the physicians what you think could be done in terms of working with organized medicine to help them come around on that.
Right. And I can only speak from the work of the American Academy of Family Physicians and work with Tyne and some of the leadership of the retail clinics. And I think the first retail clinic was about the year 2000 or so. We first kind of became aware as an organization about 2002, and then formed the working group in 2004, 2005, and have continued to monitor. We worked with Tyne early on to set up a list of what we call desired attributes, if Teen remembers that, and that basically said, yes, you need to work with the family physicians, the physician groups, coordinate with them, make sure the records are transferred, limit the scope of practice. And so at least from the Academy's viewpoint, like I said, we have 100,000 members. We've got some that do hate retail clinics, and we've got some others, particularly those in Minnesota where they've been around over a decade, that work very well with them. So at least from the viewpoint of the Academy, I think we've tried to deal with this and actually use it as a way to challenge our members that you know, consumerism is alive and well, and they better respond. If they don't like the idea of a retail clinic, they better respond in their own offices in terms of how they improve access. Other organizations may have gone about it differently, but I think the AAFP was pretty much out in front. And frankly, I was president and president-elect at that time. The leadership of the AAFP took a lot of hits at that time, too.
Okay.
Go ahead, Tim.
I think the question that you've from Winifred is a good one. I think that the reality is that healthcare is a state issue. So we have state practice laws that really regulate healthcare overall. So I would say how we operate, you know, is it really impacts the cost of care, you know, for retail clinics. And I would say some of the states, for example, that have more stringent oversight regulations, like Texas, for example, it's a more costly state to operate in. And the reality is with primary care, all of us know here, and I think, you know, Rick Kellerman talked about it early on, you know, primary care is really a low margin operation. So all of those costs potentially, when you do have regulations that are more strict, can actually, you know, impede some of the access. And it's not just for us, it's for some of these other, you know, providers that I mentioned early on and others that are trying to provide access to care.
Thank you.
Dr. Nussbaum, you've been studying the green cards. Can you
sure. First is, as we would envision, there are a whole series of questions that relate to cost. So let me sort of combine several of these. Is the discussion of cost savings referring to the system's cost, you know, the $2.3 trillion, or is it from the patient's perspective? For example, an ER visit has been shown as being significantly more costly, but some patients actually pay relatively little or nothing. And so what about out-of-pocket costs, and are really these cheaper or less costly for consumers? So maybe we could take those, that question, and then the one related to that is, you know, some questions that the costs of ER care are so high, why should we be offended whether retail clinics are skimming the easy cases? Why don't we just make sure that people get, you know, care in the most efficient, cost-effective setting? So perhaps we could speak to several of those about whose cost is it anyway?
I think it might. I think that the question is a very important one, which is that, you know, you can throw a number up there, but who's saving that money? And a couple of quick points. First is that there is a perception that there are a lot of uninsured patients who are going to the emergency department and getting free care. And I think there are some people who go to the emergency department for free care, but the majority of the visits for these kind of conditions are the insured population. So that's a key point. I think Manish made that point earlier. I just want to dispute that contention or that idea. Now, but I think the question does raise a very important point, which is that it's well and good for us to say that we are saving most of those dollar sums are accruing to society or health plans or the government payers, et cetera. And the patient itself, it matters upon their health plan product, but is going to save a relatively small fraction of those dollars. So I think it's an important point to clarify that most of those savings are going to the payers in the healthcare system. Or if you wanted to add anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say that about 35% to 40% of the people coming to the clinics now pay out of pocket. They elect to pay out of pocket. They may have a high deductible health plan. They may be uninsured. So it's a large percentage. And the average cost is about $75 for a visit. That certainly is the lowest, again, cost. I think the average cost of a physician visit, if he goes 120, and urgent care is around the same based on the TEEF study, and he can comment on that. But I was just going to sort of the counter to that is, and I just had a personal experience last summer where I was not in an area with either a retail clinic operator or on urgent care, but my mom, who was visiting from Copenhagen, Denmark, she was sick. She clearly needed to be seen, and we did end up in an emergency room, and we had a $5,000 bill. That was a difference for something. It ended up being bronchitis. That would have been treated in one of the clinics for about $75, just to show. I mean, we all experience this in this audience as well, and that's the challenge where it is. Becomes personal, and it becomes something that all of us have to deal with.
If I could just make quick point with that, which is just really emphasize that might have been some of the comments I made were about today, but as we look at the future of healthcare and health plans, and where we've seen so many more patients get consumer-directed health plans, where they have to pay a significant amount of money out of pocket, the issues and who's getting those savings is going to very much change over time. And so in that circumstance, for a patient, it's going to be much more cost advantage. There's going to have an advantage in terms of cost of going to a retail clinic or some other care site. So we may see that dynamic change over time.
Just for background and pertaining to that question is, health plans like WellPoint and peer companies basically have retail clinics in the network, so you actually get that care reimbursed if you go to a retail clinic. And one of the other important pieces is that as we contract with these organizations, one of the requirements is that information gets back to the primary care physician's offices, that evidence-based protocols are followed. So there really is a series of sort of management opportunities that actually overcome some of the concerns that have been voiced here, where to increase coordination of care, as well as to make them affordable for consumers. There's another question I just want to raise here, because it's actually to Rick, and it's one that I think we really have to take on as the way physicians are organized today. First, as Rick said, that more and more physicians are now working for health systems or working in larger groups. But physician hours of operations are probably, 4 by 6 as opposed to 24/7, and that's if you can get in. And, you know, as Institute for Healthcare Improvement and others have, and you have advocated keeping flexible schedules, but have changing physician operations had a measurable impact on ER visits, and what's helped the most? Because again, people would like to get convenient care at physicians that know them and have their medical history.
Great question. I don't know that it's measurable. I mean, if you look at the data you showed, Sam, number of emergency room visits continues to increase. So I'm not sure that we have any information that any of this is negative, has impacted on decreasing emergency room visits. I don't know that the evidence is there. Nevertheless, I think there's a larger amount of evidence that if you have a physician that you know and trust and access them appropriately, there's really good evidence that quality of care indicators go up and costs go down. So I don't know specifically in emergency room visits, but it's pretty clear that if you have a primary care health system that works well, the rest of the system works better as well.
If I can make one other quick point on that, which is the hours. So, you know, obviously, as Rick noted, we don't have data to support that. But I think one of the things that I sometimes worry about is that we do a little bit of a blame game, where we look at the people who are in the emergency department for what we perceive to be a non-urgent problem and say, well, what were you thinking to go in there for something like this? And I think it's interesting to note that from studies that have looked at patients who go to the emergency department, about 1 in 5 say, if you ask them why are they there, they say, my doc told me to come here. And so, and that might be potentially addressed by the idea of having after-hours care or weekend day, hours, too. So, again, we don't have the evidence, but at least you would think it would help.
One of the studies that, you know, one of Atif's colleagues out of University of Minnesota in Wharton, they did look actually in Minnesota at United Care data and actually saw reductions. They looked sort of geographically around the retail clinics and the emergency rooms and hospitals, and they saw a decrease both in utilization of ER use as well as hospital utilization.
You know, and one other element of decreased utilization, the program that Manish described related in Virginia where we first studied it was about a 20% reduction overall in emergency room use, and that was largely an educational campaign and one that engaged consumers. For our new patient-centered models, so we actually have patient-centered medical home models that have been up running for a few years in Colorado, New Hampshire, New York, as well as a broader strategy. And we look at the savings in those models, and they're impressive savings, but those savings are largely occurring by preventing ER visits and rehospitalizations. So that's really some of the greatest impact on the cost savings. And I think as physicians have now care management fees paid to them in medical homes and ultimately move to shared savings off budgets, there will be greater and greater incentive to keep office hours more flexible, open groups coming together to practice sort of virtually, but keeping office hours open, offices on Saturdays and other times to create a far greater access than today.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to add this. So we're all accustomed to shopping for cereal or tires, and a lot of people don't feel comfortable shopping for healthcare. I get that question all the time, Manish, great program. I haven't bought into retail health clinics. Well, Athiv has shared with you data showing that the quality of care is there. And in the near future, and this is already occurring, you're going to start to see branding of the retail health clinics or co-branding with academic institutes, known entities. I believe in Georgia, MinuteClinic is co-branding themselves with Emory. I think in the near future, you're going to hear something that impacts the D.C., Maryland market. And so this is going to become more and more common. If you think about a lot of your computers, or they might say IBM, but there are lots of times they're being made somewhere else. And that's going to start to help with the understanding of what can be accomplished in these retail health clinics. And for better or for worse, when you see X hospital system in that retail health clinic, I think the population is going to feel more comfortable accessing these places because it's a name that they know, whether it be MedStar or whomever else. And I'm not saying MedStar, that they're going to partner with anybody, but I'm just throwing out a name that most people will probably know in this area. So that's coming, and I just think that's important for this while we're having this conversation.
Very good. Yes.
Hi, my name is John Custer. I'm with ML Strategies. I had a question that kind of went back to the insurance stuff that you talked about a little bit. Is there going to be a movement on your end that tries to get insurance companies to better support some of these clinics and you know, some of these like emergency care facilities like Right Time Medical Care, places like that? Because I know with a lot of like high deductible insurance policies that people are paying for individually out of pocket, you can get an ER visit paid for in full if you need like an X-ray or anything like that for $75 up front, which essentially goes as a copay. But if you go and you haven't met your deductible to a place like Right Time Medical Care because you need an X-ray and you don't want to wait, you're going to end up paying like $500, $600, $700 after you get the X-ray, the crushes, and if they cashed in, those sort of things, where, you know, an ER would just cover it for $75. Now, I mean, obviously somebody has a broken bone, that's a little more urgent than a runny nose, but I think it kind of is a one-size-fits-all with a lot of these insurance plans where they don't cover, you know, the visits to these sort of places where they will cover an ER, and that kind of, I think, leads to part of the overburdening of the ER as well, because people don't want to pay all that extra money when they already have a high deductible that they're paying out for.
Can I just expand that question a little bit? That it raises the question of ER pricing practices, if you will. There is in your materials a piece that quotes some ER Academy folks as saying that the marginal cost of going to the emergency room, depending on the time of day, isn't all that much higher or maybe even lower than some other places to get that care. And I don't know whether WellPoint and other insurers have negotiated the kind of cash-only deal that the gentleman was describing more generally for their subscribers. Any aspect?
Let me take that, and Manish can add to it. First of all, in general, health plans cover urgent care and retail visits, as I mentioned, as part of their networks and as part of coverage, and we negotiate, as we do with others, the reimbursement for those visits. So those institutions that you're mentioning are generally in our networks, and we encourage, when appropriate, their use, the same way we certainly endorse support emergency room care when it's needed. In fact, if anything, if you look at today's insurance products, those visits to emergency rooms that are viewed as routine and care are very much at very high copays, I mean, $150 or more. So there is a financial set of payments to emergency rooms that are vastly higher than would be into a clinical setting. Your question, though, gets to a larger issue, and it's one of the questions that we got here is Florida Blues, Highmark, I think others, that actually insurance companies are operating retail clinics. And I think you'll see more and more of investment in support for these centers, the same way you'll see that support in primary care. So our new primary care strategy at WellPoint says that part of that sort of agreement between the doctor and the insurance plan, the company, would be to have far greater access than you have today. So if we're paying a monthly coordination fee, which we are, or other fees that are about sort of the continuum of care. We don't want doctors for routine care to say, go to the emergency room, our office is closed. So that's part of the sort of agreement that we have going forward that would make the doctor's office more accessible. But the model that you talk about where we would encourage people to go to emergency room for non-emergency room conditions really doesn't exist to my knowledge. Manish?
Yeah, Sam, so you're asking kind of a benefit design question. I can tell you what we're practicing at WellPoint. We know for there to be financial drivers for people to utilize ER alternatives. If your ER copay, just to give an easy number, is $100, we try to price the ER alternatives, so that includes your retail health clinics and your urgent care, at one-third of that. So we want to be somewhere between $0 and $33. Is what we try to do. Now, the example you gave of the ER actually turning out to be cheaper, I'm not aware of that, but that comes down to benefit design. But I can tell you from a 30,000-foot level, that's how we try to encourage these ER alternatives, by using that ratio that I just explained to you. Thank you.
Yes, John?
I'm John Green with the National Association of Health Underwriters. Sort of stole a little of my thunder on that question, because I took my son to Right Night or Right Time or whatever, because I got to my primary care and their office was dark when they were supposed to be open. And it was for, he had, I thought maybe he had strep, but it turned out he had a really bad sinus infection. I want to twist this question about the cost out of pocket a little bit. I have a health savings account, and I love the electronic medical record. I love the convenience of it. I love being treated like a customer. It was kind of a nice experience, but it cost a little more than I thought it would. What about this issue relative to transparency of cost? If we're going to these sorts of facilities for what is deemed as kind of your run-of-the-mill sinus infection, why can't you post what the price is so I would know? That's the one extra step that you could take that's different from our usual interaction with the healthcare system, to know this is what it's going to cost. And maybe I'll pay out of pocket and pay cash, and maybe get a little better price than running it through the insurance company if I know it's going to be $75 to treat the strep or whatever it is.
I don't know which one you went to, but usually actually the prices are posted, and also if you go to the websites, you'll see sort of a general range of the price, not to exceed that. I mean, there are some tests involved in some of them, and that's why we say the average price is $75, but I'm surprised, you know, that you would not have, you know, a price list. That's usually what we see in our clinics. There is a range depending on what tests they do, but the range, you know, by far, you know, it won't surpass a certain amount. So, you know, maybe we can talk afterwards which one it was you went to, because I'm curious about that. And that's something we actually, you know, pride ourselves with, that price, there is price transparency.
Can I make one quick point on that? So one of the unique aspects of retail clinics is that, at least the ones that I'm aware of, they do have the prices online and on the little board they have in front of the clinic. And so it's a relatively unique experience for a patient to know. And we did a study where we interviewed a number of people who went to retail clinics, and ask them what was driving their interest. And for those who were uninsured, in that case, there weren't that many consumer-directed health plans, patients who were paying for it out of pocket, that price transparency was one of the critical drivers. And so one of the mothers who brought her son there said to us, you know, I know how much it's going to cost. If I go to my doctor's office or if I go to the emergency department, neither the doctor nor the emergency department provider knows how much it's going to cost, and I get this exorbitant bill in the mail afterwards, and we know about all the issues of pricing in the healthcare system. So I think you've really hit upon a key point, which is this price transparency, and how much we can continue to try to encourage that in other care settings, I think, is really important.
Yes. Just one thing on that, and I agree, and I like the price transparency. I think more physician offices should do it as well. When I see a patient, though, we sometimes don't know exactly what that cost is going to be. For example, if I saw your son and he had a sore throat and he had pus on his tonsils and I got a strep throat and it was negative, the second thing that I might think about is a mono test, because mononucleosis sometimes shows up as a sore throat. So that's going to add additional cost when I do that test. And I just say that because sometimes when the patient walks in with a sore throat, we don't know exactly what the diagnosis is going to be, and strep throat is just one simple example of that.
Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Summers. I'm with the American Nurses Association, and we've worked closely with Teens Group and AARP and others to try to address some of the barriers that limit MPs and other advanced practice nurses from providing care in settings like this. So I want to say thank you very much for the panel and all the information. But the question that I wanted to ask, what really intrigued me, was a very brief comment that Dr. Osa made when you were talking about the 24/7 nurse lines, and you mentioned RNs being able to triage, and you talked about they used to ask a lot of questions, and you've streamlined that. And I was very intrigued by that, because certainly what we hear from nurses is they have a lot of skills and knowledge that can help patients get the right care at the right time. But very often they're limited by these scripts, and as you said, you know, I myself have sat and answered a gazillion questions that were irrelevant. So I'm just wondering if you can expand on that a little bit in terms of how that went. I can imagine the lawyers may have had some angst about that. And if you see that as a trend with all the we're depending more and more on nurses to do things like that in care coordination settings, et cetera.
Sure. Great question. So, yes, the lawyers did get very excited when we started deleting questions. And so some of the questions we got rid of is allergies to medications. You know, if somebody's got a sore throat, and not for all instances, but, you know, allergies to medications, if someone you're triaging somebody with a sore throat, what do I want to know as an ER doc? Are they having any shortness of breath? Are they having any trouble swallowing? Can they handle their secretions? Those are the kind of questions you want to get to. And if none of those are yeses, then you start to get to, do you have a fever, and some of the other things that we may want to know. So streamlining the questions that are pertinent. Another one is last menstrual period. Why is it relevant, right? But these are a lot of questions that were in there. And again, when you have a sore throat, the last thing you want to do is be on the phone for 10 minutes answering irrelevant questions. When was your last tetanus shot? Well, why is that relevant, right? So let's get rid of the things that you don't need. This is a registered nurse. She's clinical, right? So let her, from a legal standpoint, we can't just let them, you know, totally practice medicine over the phone. But there are certain questions we have to ask. And ultimately, it's the patient has the prerogative to say to still go to the emergency room or a retail health clinic. Remember, this is a service that we give our members that's underutilized, but a lot of people here weren't sure about when to go where for what. And I just want to always drive home some of the complaints that we got with the nurse hotline was, well, they're asking us irrelevant questions and it takes too long. Well, we made it one step easier. Is it perfect? No. But it's better than it was, so that if somebody's calling with something like a rash or they just cut themselves, and that's a perfect example, a cut happens all the time. Well, do I go to the ER or do I go to a retail health clinic? Well, retail health clinic today would be wrong because they don't do stitches if it needs stitches. So the nurse has got to go a little deeper on, well, can you approximate the edges of the wound? How much is it bleeding? Is it pulsatile? Right? Because then that might mean you have an artery. So those are the kind of things that they'll ask to triage. And again, we're guiding the member. If the member doesn't feel comfortable going to the retail health clinic, that's their prerogative. They still have they can go to the emergency room or wherever they want. But what the one thing we want to do is make sure the experience that the member had when they called the nurse hotline was a good one.
Well, kudos to you. I'm sure the nurses really appreciate it as well.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We have a couple more folks here, and we have a bunch of cards yet to be voiced that you've sent forward. So if you really need to get your question answered, you probably need to go to a microphone. And also I would ask in these last 10 or so minutes that you listen to the back and forth of the Q&A while you take out that blue evaluation form and fill it out. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sandra Wilkness from Senator Bingaman's office, and one of those is my card, so you can get rid of that. My question is about behavioral health. I'm wondering what proportion of the visits involve a behavioral health component, whether it's verbalized as a chief complaint or identified as one, and how you all handle those.
Very good question.
So, well, I mean, in terms of, we don't, you know, there's two things going on in the retail clinic. There's the scope of services and certainly the scope of practice of the, you know, the clinician, usually a nurse practitioner. A lot of other healthcare issues are identified in the visit. So part of it is assuring, make sure you have the right referral mechanism in place when you identify behavioral health types of issues. And we certainly see that and hear that from our members. Not only behavioral health, we see that with chronic diseases that we're not treating, where there needs to be a connection point to our primary care provider. Again, we see the relationship with a medical home as a critical one. The challenge always comes up when we identify those up to 60% that may not have a medical home, so getting that first and then getting them into proper care. But all of our members have relationships, referral relationships with health systems and other providers, really to account for what they, you know, the kinds of issues that they see that come up in the clinic.
And could I just ask, Manish, in your diversion initiative at WellPoint, how do you deal with behavioral health questions that arise?
Behavioral health questions, if they were to call the nurse hotline, they would go through their triage system, the questions that were relevant to a mental screening exam to make sure where that person needed to be. When we talk about behavioral health, there's two things, and I don't know if this answers your question or if I'm going off, but when Sam talked earlier about frequent flyers, a small percentage of the population, 5%, accounting for 10 to 20 or 30% of the spend, behavioral health is a big component of frequent flyers. I see that when I'm working clinically, a lot of people with mental health coming to the emergency room out of desperation because they're lost in the system, they potentially have some drug dependencies, and they're ending up in the ER, alcohol dependency. And the other component of the frequent flyers are people with chronic conditions that are just lost in the system. So they have chronic pain, whether it be belly pain, back pain, leg pain, and they're just lost. They've been to the neurologist. They've had all the MRIs you can get, but they're just lost in the system, and no doctor has taken ownership of them, and they end up in the emergency room. And unfortunately, we have no silver bullets in the emergency room. So I will rule out any life-threatening emergency. I will do appropriate scanning, and sometimes unnecessary scanning, because I don't have all the CAT scans and MRIs and x-rays that they've had in the past. And then, unfortunately, I'll give them a referral, and they'll be still lost in the system. Because a lot of these people have bounced from specialist to primary care, haven't gotten a solution, and I call them the lost souls. They're just going wherever they can go, ER to ER sometimes. Many of them we make worse by prescribing them narcotics, and then they become addicted to the narcotics. So unfortunately, I don't have a great solution for them. But when I think of behavioral health, emergency room, they're a big part of the frequent flyers that we see.
I just wanted to follow up. Just quick thought, given the high prevalence, there are some very brief interventions that can be incorporated into clinics like yours that can address immediate concerns and then refer out. So just a thought.
As a family physician, I've got to comment on this one. Every visit has some behavioral health component. We teach our medical students that patients do not experience a medical problem in a vacuum. And not necessarily all of those need some kind of treatment, but monitoring of that and screening for behavioral health issues and the amount of costs that the healthcare system absorbs because of behavioral health and mental health issues is extremely important. You need to have one of these things on behavioral issues.
Indeed. We actually did about a month ago. We have another one coming up in the fall. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Justin Jones. I'm with the Health Policy Project at the New America Foundation. And my question was about the urgent care clinics and advertising. I've lived in communities where the urgent care clinics do very aggressive advertising, up to having billboards with the current wait time at their clinic. And then I've been in communities where there's virtually none. Do you know, is there any correlation between advertising and making more use of these clinics?
It would be un-American to suggest otherwise.
Or have there been any studies done looking at that?
Go ahead, Mitch.
So that's an interesting question. We've got emergency rooms doing the same thing. They're advertising their wait times. They're on the billboards. They're even creating slots in the emergency room where you can go online and book your time. And that's a head scratcher for me and Sam, right? If you're booking a time to go to the emergency room, then it's not an emergency, right? Then why are you there to begin with? But so everybody, it's the American way. Everybody's advertising anything they can do to get people into their facility, whether it be the emergency room or the urgent care. I'm seeing it more on the ER side than I am the urgent cares, actually, which is concerning for me. Hospital systems advertising, you know, wait times less than 15 minutes. There's a lot of systems out there that are doing it. And the reality of it is these quick itises are cash cows for the ER. I, as an ER doc, can look in your throat within 30 seconds or a minute and tell you what it is, or do a rapid strep test and tell you what it is. So what the emergency rooms are actually doing, catering to what you're saying, is they're giving these quick wait times, and you come in and go through what's called our rapid evaluation unit. You come in, you got a sore throat, we take your Blue Cross Blue Shield card, somebody's swiping that, we swab your throat, and our mid-level providers, the nurse practitioners, the RNs that you're seeing in the that staff the retail health clinics, are the ones that are typically taking care of you in these rapid evaluation units in the ER. But you're paying an ER copay, and WellPoint is paying an ER price for treating that strep throat in the emergency room. It's the $500 to $600 potentially, as opposed to the $85 that would have been in the retail health clinic, or $100 at your primary care or urgent care. Hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Rafael Samansky. I'm a consultant. Just one quick comment and a question. I don't think anyone's been in an ER room in DC, because we're talking about wait times of 5 to 10 hours in DC. My second question would be, just following up with Dr. Kellerman's comment, you know, I think there's a bigger issue around kind of how family physicians coordinate information from other providers, whether it's from a provider at a minute clinic or a specialist. And I can't tell you how many visits I've had with my primary care provider or a specialist where they haven't even looked at any of the other material they've gotten from any of the other providers. And I know from friends who have parents who are, you know, have chronic conditions, what happens is the poor parent has to keep seeing the doctor so the doctor can get paid for his time to basically read the information from other providers. And, you know, I'm wondering to what extent the medical home is really going to be able to deal with the lack of time that physicians spend using the information that's available to them, whether it arrives on a Monday morning or through a fax or by a patient. You know, because obviously a 10 to 15 minute visit is too short a time period for someone to actually go through all the information. And I think there's an unnecessary reliance on patient recall. I can't tell you how many times my physicians ask me about questions that are in the electronic medical record. So I think it's a bigger issue than just the retail clinics.
Well, several years ago, the Academy and a couple of the other physician organizations put out principles of the patient-centered medical home, and they included things like the things we're talking about here: improved access, quality measurement, the importance of health information technology. One of those principles, though, was payment reform for primary care. Based on most of the current system, primary care physicians are primarily paid fee-for-service, so we're only paid when we see the patient. Yet there's an estimate that about a sixth to a third of what a primary care physician does is unreimbursed. And it's unreimbursed not because the patient doesn't have insurance, or it's not unreimbursed because it went to bad debts. It's unreimbursed because there's no way to pay for it in a fee-for-service environment. So I know that WellPoint and a lot of the other insurance companies are looking at different ways to pay for primary care, and that has to happen if this is going to work. Again, I think it points back to the neglect that we've had for primary care in this country. Sam might want to comment on that.
Sure. I fully agree with Rick. We are developing models, the medical home models, where we pay care coordination fees. And in addition, we are increasing the payment generally overall, and certainly want to make sure that we pay differentially for urgent care, after-hours care, as we do today. But ultimately, it's the accountability for the continuum of care that appropriately would be in a doctor's office. So we and other companies are certainly moving in this direction, and we need to do more. The last question I'd like to pose is one that you've posed that sort of looks to the future. And it's whether patients will be willing to accept long-term chronic care management in retail clinics without visiting physicians. So it's sort of, as we look to the future and we think beyond these self-limited, often self-limited illnesses, how do you see, team, the retail clinics evolving? Because we know many are thinking of moving in the direction of education, chronic care management, looking at a very different model. Will consumers accept that? And then if so, Rick, now we're crossing a little bit of a boundary line, aren't we, with primary care? And so what will the model evolve to?
So it's a great question, Sam. I mean, obviously, the retail clinic providers and the clinicians, the nurse practitioners, are very capable of partnering with other providers to really meet the chronic care needs of many patients. We've always said that it needs to be a partnership here with the medical home, and I think we agree on that in terms of this. It needs to be a coordination with somebody that can see the full spectrum of a patient. What we see now is we provide a lot of access in terms of retail hours. I mean, I think about somebody who has diabetes and need a hemoglobin A1C, certainly accessible. You can go in the mornings, at lunchtime, or after hours, or on the weekends. So it becomes a little bit more manageable to have a chronic illness. Now, we are seeing with our members some co-management, already of chronic disease management. I mentioned earlier, for example, one of our colleagues, a member's MinuteClinic, that has an affiliation, for example, with Cleveland Clinic, where they are doing some bidirectional treatment. But again, Cleveland Clinic is serving as the medical home, but there's co-management of the patient, and that those services and how they co-manage is reflected in the record, and there's a lot of partnership back and forth between both the clinic operator as well as the primary care provider.
Right, I agree. I think it has to be coordinated with the physician, and there's a lot of difference between just taking a blood pressure and managing high blood pressure. You have to think about, well, are there, for example, secondary causes of high blood pressure, renal artery stenosis, for example. Sometimes we make it look too easy in medicine, I think. I used to send my patients to the fire department because they had firemen that checked blood pressures. I'd say, you get your blood pressure checked regularly, but bring those in so that I can take a look at them. So there's a difference between screening and doing a test and actually managing that patient's condition.
Okay, a good word on which to conclude. A fascinating discussion, one that's immediately relevant to a lot of people's lives and to some policy developments that are underway, whether the train has left the station or not. Let me just take a moment to thank you for your participation and for filling out those evaluation forms after the constant badgering by one of the moderators. I neglected to mention and certainly want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation for providing the webcast that will be available tomorrow on their website, kff.org, or through the Alliance at allhealth.org. Certainly want to thank our colleagues at WellPoint for their co-sponsorship and support and obvious contribution through their participation in this briefing, and ask you to help me thank our panel for a really illuminating discussion on a tough topic. Thank you.